please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. I
pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, next on the agenda is roll call. And I don't know what to say about Dan, so...
Motion to excuse him if the council wishes.
It's up to the council. Do I hear a motion? Whether to excuse him or not, that's up to the council. Motion to what, Gina? Excuse Dan? Okay, we have a second by Charles. Any discussion? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same? Okay, then Dan will be excused for tonight, unless he happens to show up.
Next week.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Next on the agenda is current business, NPDES permit discussion. Nancy with Gino, want to come? Let us know how our permitting's going, and also explain what NPDES is.
Okay. Well, NPDES stands for...
Okay, well, Dan just showed up. Okay.
NPDES stands for National Pollution Discharge Elimination, which is the key part of that system. So it's basically the, that came from the Clean Water Act in the 70s. By the way, does everybody have this for your files? If not, I have another copy if it's something you want to reference later, but hopefully it was in your packets. I'm sort of here to give just a short presentation on where we're at now, but certainly if there's more questions, I don't know if there's any new faces on council since I was here. I was here about maybe 8-9 months ago. But I'll do, again, a quick overview of your treatment plant because I'm sure it's not where you all visit often. But it was first built in 1955. It's a lagoon system. You have two 20-acre cells. There's some, in 1981, you built additional lagoons. In 1992, you did minor upgrades, but essentially it's a facultative lagoon system. What does that mean? It means your wastewater goes into that lagoon and it just sits there for like 60-some days or something like that, and by the time it's discharged out the other end, in theory, you have all of the pollutants are gone that are required to be gone per permit. The wastewater is discharged into Owl Creek, and what's important about that is that Owl Creek is a tributary to Crab Creek. And I'll explain a little bit more about Crab Creek. And the permit is issued by the Department of Ecology. So this permit is like any permit you would have for anything else. It says what you can and can't do. Similar to, I try to break it down into the most basic thing. Like you get a fishing permit or a hunting license, and it tells you all the things that you can and can't do by state law. The city has an NPDES permit that says what you can and can't do with your sewage. This is just... So there's Cunningham Road, so the city's kind of over here, and your main influent comes into here. It's split into these two ponds. Pond 2, 3, and 4 are, again, just, these are all ponds that just sit there. There's no aeration in them. They just are what we call facultative. And what facultative really is that the lagoon is in layers. These are about, I think there might be 8 to 10 feet deep. I'm not exactly sure how deep they are, but so there's a treatment on the top, treatment in the center, and treatment at the very bottom. But essentially, the city doesn't do any mechanical treatment. They just sit there. They let nature do more of the work. The discharge, there's a little operations building there, and then your discharge is to Owl Creek out here. So the discharge to Owl Creek is important because that's a tributary to Crab Creek. And Crab Creek is one of those in the state of Washington, actually, in the United States, that's very important. It is believed to be one of the longest, if not the longest watershed, or I shouldn't say longest, the largest watershed drainage. And I looked up the square miles today and darned if I cannot remember it. But it's one of the largest watersheds in the United States. So anything that has any kind of distinction of being the largest and the best, of course, gets extra attention by environmental groups and the government, anything like that. Your current permit was issued in January of 2010. And this might come as a surprise to people. Well, it's only 3 years. It came as a surprise to Gray and Osborne as well, because typically these discharge permits are 5 years. That was one of our questions to Ecology, is why is this a 3-year permit? And the answer from Ecology was, well, they had, you know, they permit hundreds and hundreds of facilities. in the eastern region. So you're permitted out of an office in Spokane. And they were all coming due at the same time. They didn't have the personnel to handle those permits. So they were trying to spread them out by giving facilities three-year permits and just basically trying to spread those permits out so they didn't all come due at the same time. So you had a three-year permit. I'm real hopeful the next one is a five-year permit. I have never seen a three-year permit. This was quite a surprise to me, but I have heard of another facility in Eastern Region that this happened to. And I'm told it's just to spread the permit out. They're not trying to do anything or pull a fast one in any way. This is just kind of an administrative thing. So the permit essentially allows discharge of pollutants into the creek. And what that means is just that they say you're allowed to discharge X amount of pollutants, and that's okay. A lot of people think, well, if you don't have a permit, then you can discharge whatever you want. No, if you don't have a permit, you can't discharge any pollutants. You are allowed to discharge a small amount of pollutants that has already been determined not to affect the environment. So that's kind of what the permit does, is it allows this discharge. And in that permit, you know, it's about a 35-page document. There's limits on the effluent, so that literally means what those permits pollutants are and how many pounds you can put into the creek. This mixing zone analysis and limitations. So ecology does a certain amount of analysis of Owl Creek and your wastewater and says, what can you discharge into Owl Creek before you're going to start hurting the environment? In that permit, there's monitoring requirements, so the guys out at the treatment plant have to do a certain amount of weekly testing, monthly testing, and then some of that testing is only every 2 or 3 years. I believe they also test some monitoring wells. And in addition to what's really important there is they also do they constantly test out in the creek. That's required by their permit. So there's a fairly lengthy list, I think it's about 3 or 4 pages of monitoring that they have to do. And then they submit that to the Department of Ecology on a set of reports called DMRs, or discharge monitoring reports. So that's your permit. There's a lot of information there, so if you have any questions, you know, let me know. So your current status is that you have to apply for renewal in June of 2013, and we're working on that application right now. We have, and that application consists of, we take the last 3 years of all that monitoring data they've done, and we assemble it into a form that's provided by the EPA. On February 13th, we conducted a phone conference with Ecology just to kind of get our feet on the ground, see if there was any expectations. One of the questions was, why is this a three-year permit? If they saw any, you know, things that, it was sort of to feel them out to see if there was anything out of the blue that might come out of this. But we also pointed out several documents that the city had submitted as part of their permit and never received comment on. You submitted 2 or 3 reports or of different nature and never received any comments on them, and so we wanted to inquire about that. In general, with your current permit, you're in pretty good shape in terms of, do you comply with it, do you follow the rules, etc. The places where you have problems is this influent total suspended solids. Your permit says you can only receive so many pounds of, this is just literally the floating matter in your wastewater. And your permit says you can only receive a certain amount of pounds. Well, this has been a known problem for a number of years. So one of the reports that you submitted last year, and I believe this is when I was here the last time, was called a PMAC or a PMAC, and that's just a fancy word for a report that stated, how do these solids affect the treatment plant? What's the theory on where they're coming from? It was just an overall summary. We also did some additional testing with that to see if they were biological solids, are they inert solids like sands and gravel. Out of that report, we made several conclusions. There was like 5 or 6 reasons why we felt that this wasn't a concern for the city at this time. And we also proposed that Ecology raise that level of capacity. I can't remember off the top of my head right now what it is, but we wanted them to raise it because, number one, it just really doesn't affect your treatment plant. And the problem with it is, though, every time you're over capacity, it goes into Ecology as a violation. Violations are now posted on the internet. Anybody can go out and look at any facility and find violations. So my problem with this is that it does not affect your current treatment plant. Why is that limit even there? and it needs to be raised so that it's not a constant violation. I think we made a good argument in the report, but again, we never received any response from Ecology, and that was one of the things we asked in our February 13th phone conference with them, is that the city needs to have that capacity raised. And it has absolutely no bearing on your current treatment plant, and that's what bothers me about it, yet it shows up as a violation. So we talked to them about that. You do violate coliforms, and this is essentially like fecal matter. And part of the problem there is that you have a nice little duck and geese and whatever else out there, and that contributes to that problem at the treatment plant. It doesn't come from the actual municipal sewage. It's because you have so much waterfowl out there. And because you run lagoons, you have a lot of algae. That's just the byproduct of a lagoon system. And because of that algae, sometimes you violate pH, which is just another permit condition. And you violate on the total suspended solids going out of the treatment plant. Again, that's not from the sewage. That's from the algae that goes out of the treatment plant. And that's considered a suspended solid. These bottom three, I'm not really sure there's a whole lot you could do about them, because that's the type of system that you run. This top one, and these violations are, not to discount them, they are violations, but we're talking one or two of those a year. This one happens quite frequently, and this is the one that you can control and should control. And so we'll stress as much as we can to get Ecology to raise that limit so it's not a violation. Overall, I think your treatment plant performs to the permit fine. I mean, you don't have any gross violations that are, you know, something that you could control, or most, like I said, the bottom three are not. They're just the result of having a lagoon system. So possible permit changes, I keep stressing this because I think it's really important, is we're hopeful that Ecology raises that design capacity for total suspended solids. When I came here, I don't know, 8 months ago, I explained to you, that's actually a design capacity that is from like a 1977 report, and it's based on book values and population. It's not based on actual data, because I suspect in 1977 they just didn't have the data. So now we have, part of that report was actual data, actual information. So that's a really important and key part to that, is that the data was from 30 years ago. The second part is that Ecology may require increased testing, and I bring this up because whole effluent toxicity or wet testing is very expensive, and it's just something that when you do budget, I believe that if they require this, you'd be required to do it once per permit cycle, and it's just expensive testing. And essentially what that is I don't know all of the details, but they send a sample of wastewater off, put it into an aquarium with some guppies and some other types of aquatic life to see if that aquatic life lives. There's more to it than that, but that's essentially what it is. And those tests can run along the lines I have heard before of $10,000 to $20,000. And that's why I bring that up, because it's not just running a test into Yakima for a couple hundred dollars. So when that testing comes about, the city will want to research the costs into that and make sure that's built into your budget. You were kind of given a pass on that last time because the city just kind of said, you know, hey, give us a break, this is expensive stuff, but I don't know if you'll get a pass on it because of the size of treatment plant you are. You don't have to do wet testing if you're below a certain level. You guys are well above that level. They've just sort of been giving you guys a break, and I don't know how long that's going to last. You may be required to do additional creek monitoring. They're always just increasing how much testing you have to do in the creek. So, and then my third thing is that Ecology is unpredictable. They pretty much have a whole new set of people in their Spokane office. And with that, of course, comes just an unpredictable. We just don't know. Had it been the people that were in there 5 years ago, I could have told you probably what would happen. But with this new set of people, I just don't know exactly how they're going to view the small town or view your status here. The other thing is that I did ask in that 13th meeting, the meeting on February 13th, if they would be modeling the creek again. That is important because every time they go out and take a look at that creek and they update the information based on all of the current data, it is important to know if you're going to violate any water quality standards, because that would affect your permit limits. So every time they remodel that creek, And it's just a fancy Excel spreadsheet or computer program they use. Every time they model that, there's an opportunity that they could change something if in fact the model spits out that you're going to violate water quality standards. I do not know, I mean, that modeling effort's a fairly in-depth effort. I don't know, based on your current data, if anything will change in that modeling effort. Overall, regulations will never relax. Your permit is only going to get tighter. it's a pollution discharge elimination system. I mean, they want to eliminate all pollution. So regulations aren't relaxing, and noncompliance is an issue. Now, I've talked about the fact that you guys do have some permit violations. You know, the total suspended solids one can be taken care of if we can convince Ecology that our report is accurate. Some of the other violations are the result of having a lagoon system, but it's still a violation in terms of your permit. Other cities that have had compliance issues have been forced into upgrading treatment plants. Some of that comes from the fact that some of it comes from growth spurts. Some of it comes from the fact that they just have really old treatment plants. So there's a wide variety of reasons why other cities have come into non-compliance. But essentially what can happen is you can get fined. You guys aren't there yet. I'm just letting you know what happens when you get one of these permits that is more constricting. We've seen cities get fined. We've seen cities have sewer moratoriums, which just means that you can't develop any longer, no more sewer connections. The state is always evaluating nutrient removal requirements. So what that is the state in 2008 or 2009 went through this big study, you know, what would it take to make these permits more restrictive? For example, currently you don't have a limit on nitrogen and phosphorus, and those are considered nutrients of concern. So the state went through and kind of did this study, well, what would it do to all these facilities if we made them remove nitrogen and phosphorus? And so just by the fact that they looked at that means that those are some of the parameters that could be coming down to a city like Othello if, in fact, Ecology wanted to tighten the regulations, or, in fact, if that modeling effort showed that you were going to violate state water quality standards. Total maximum daily load studies continue. So many creeks and rivers in the state are on these sort of watch lists. It's called a 303D list, and Crab Creek is on the 303D list, but it kind of depends on where you're at in Crab Creek, which reach of it, what is on there. What I mean by that is it on the list because it's too warm? Is it on the list because it has high pH? Is it on the list because it has how many oxygen in the creek? So once these creeks make it on, or rivers make it on the 303D list, EPA requires Ecology to do a big fancy study called a total maximum daily load. Again, I bring this up because there are TMDLs on Crab Creek. So far they don't affect you, but that it only is something that continues to be studied. The more they study it, the more they have an opportunity to impose stricter effluent limits. And there's always that thought of if, in fact, somebody wanted to get interested in the city and their discharge and what you violate and what you do and what you don't do, all of that is very much public information, easier to access than ever. They made a really nice database system on the internet for people to go out and look that stuff up. Because you are under the NPDES program, a third party can come in and file lawsuits against facilities that are out of compliance. I'm not saying this is going to happen to you. I'm just sort of telling you what other cities are facing. And I tell you that because I know that you guys have been sort of saving money in the event that you ever have to upgrade your treatment plant. I am hopeful that your permit comes out as it has the last couple times. The reason I say that is because your city's not really changing a whole lot. I mean, you haven't had any giant industries move in that discharge to the municipal facility. You've had some growth, but nothing crazy. So essentially, you're just a run-of-the-mill Eastern Washington city that hasn't really experienced a lot of change. So my feeling is I don't think your permit will change. But I think that based on all those things, the state's looking at nutrient removal, the TMDL studies on Crab Creek, all the other things, that it is prudent for you and good practice to save for that day when you have to upgrade your treatment plant, because I think it will come someday. I don't know that it'll come this time, like I said, just because your city's not really changing. So the next steps in this process are, we will submit a draft application to the city for review. The city is required to submit that permit application by June 30th. Then Ecology sends you a letter that says we have all the application materials, or if they don't, they might send you a letter that says, hey, can you do more testing here, more testing there, or something like that. Ecology will issue the permit to the city for a factual review. And that's where it's real important that we look at that permit and make sure that it is fact, if there is some major changes. After that, Ecology will issue the permit for public comment. Again, if there's major changes that we need to assist the city in commenting on. That is the point where you really get to, you or any other, you know, public entity can comment on the permit. Depending on changes, if your permit is significantly different, then we would certainly work with the city and come back here and discuss that with you. All of this is about a one-year process from June 30th, so you may not hopefully ever have to see me again, but if in fact there are changes in your permit, we would be back here in probably 8 to 9 months to discuss those. I hate to say that it's very unpredictable, but it is, because Ecology, it's a whole new set of people, and they can certainly take all of the new data, put it into the new permit, and they may come up with something completely different based on new regulations. So that was the really fast version of permit summary. I don't know if anybody has any questions. I'm hopeful that you don't see me again, in a way, because I don't, but I'm also hopeful that since your city's not changing, it goes through as it has the last couple years. It is important that total suspended solid loading is raised. And I think if it's not raised, I would almost encourage the city to consider appealing that to the Pollution Control Board. I mean, that's just a thought. The problem I have with that, it's a violation that's not really a violation. And so you could be subject to something there that's not really, hate to sound cliche, but it's not fair. And so we'll work with Ecology to hopefully get that TSS limit raised and not have to go that far with it. Any other questions?
So when we get forced into putting in a plant, I guess, does that come with a lot of expenses, I suppose, running something like that?
If in fact, well, if you want to go there, I'll go there. If in fact something came back in this permit that required you to go away from lagoon treatment. Mm-hmm. Lagoon treatment is, there are other treatment technologies that produce a higher quality of effluent. If in fact your permit came back after modeling efforts and Ecology goes through their look at the creek and everything, and you had a limit for, say, ammonia, or they wouldn't do it at this time, but maybe in the future, like nitrogen or phosphorus, your current treatment plant could not meet those limits. It's just not made for it. The technology is just not there. Those types of things would force you into a mechanical plant or some kind of upgrade where you get a higher level of treatment. And that's going to be very expensive. That's why I know that you're saving and establishing reserves for that, and I think that's very good, and I don't want you to, if this permit comes back and everything's hunky-dory, you know, that's not, you know, you just need to continue sort of your course. I think before, when we were here, we said if you went to a traditional treatment plant, something similar to a Moses Lake or a Warden or a Freda, I'm just trying to think of some ones around here, more traditional treatment plant for your size of the community, probably looking at anywhere from a $20 to a $22 million project. And again, that's all dependent on if Ecology comes back with an effluent limit that you can't meet with lagoons. And lagoons were all you needed in 1955 when you started down this road, or 70s when you upgraded them. But yes, that's the cost of treatment, likely around 20 to 22 million.
Questions, Council?
Mm-hmm. I have a comment here, if I could. Nancy, you talked about submittal of the PMAC and a talked with DOE about it. I think it's important the council hear what their response was.
Oh, about the level of service and not commenting?
Yes.
Yeah, we just said, you know, we didn't receive any comments on this. Are you going to comment? Because it's a very important part of, you know, your submittal. It was very important. And Ecology said that they had got new personnel, they were going to increase the level of service, and they would have comments within 30 days on any submittal. So we're at March 4th. They have a few more days. We'll see if we get comments within 30 days. I've never heard of an Ecology person promising comments within 30 days, but that's what she said. They would try to improve their level of service. You also turned in a pretreatment ordinance and an industrial user survey and never received any comments. And what's important about that is they need to acknowledge at least that they received them. I mean, we followed up, but you can only follow up to a phone answering machine so long before you just... So it's not only the PMAC, but the other two items, and they said they would comment within 30 days and have a better level of service.
You said we did some testing on the TSS, the influent TSS, and determined what was causing that. What was it exactly?
Well, we don't exactly know what was causing it, but it was very interesting because we determined that it was actually organic. This is organic, but it didn't degrade in a five-day BOD test, which is unusual.
Yeah.
And we determined in our report that because you have some food industries in town, there are food wastes that are organic but will not show up in a five-day BOD just because they don't burn off at 550 or whatever the criteria is for that. So we had suggested at that time that the city possibly go out and just, maybe you have a cross connection, you know, certainly doesn't mean that somebody's doing something illegal knowingly. It's not like we've never run across a cross connection before. And at that time we recommended to the city to go around and do some portable sampling, and I think the city purchased a portable sampler, took it out to manhole, but I don't believe they really found anything that was all that conclusive where they could sit there and say, it's coming from that facility. I don't know if you guys want to comment on that. I received some faxes and it didn't.
We did some testing up north here. We did some down here on south. We did some back over here on Columbia and 4th, and some of the residentials over here and the food industry, but it pretty much flatlined. There wasn't anything that just jumped out at us to give us any of that issue that we have.
We have been looking at sampling point too to see if sampling point could be an issue, but it's so consistently over that it is very consistent, and so that's what makes you think that it is. And the oddity that it's so total suspended solids, part of that is actually organic material, and then part of it can just be sands and gravels and things that are inert. Well, in the city of Othello, your total suspended solids, and there's a particular ratio, like 80% should be volatile. Well, in Othello, with that high suspended solids, one might think, is that a lot of inert materials coming in, sands and gravels, or is that a lot of biological? In your case, we determined, as I mentioned, that it's biological, but it doesn't show up on one of these other tests, which makes us think that it's something kind of unique, and that's why we thought maybe a food waste rather than just your typical household domestic wastewater. So, at this point, inconclusive. I do say, though, that if you were forced to go to another type of treatment, it might be more important. As I said, currently it doesn't affect your current treatment plant. That's why I think it needs to be raised and it needs to be something taken care of. If you had a different type of treatment plant, we might want to do a lot of investigation to figure out what that is, because it would affect a mechanical treatment plant.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Nancy, for coming and enlightening us on this, since we're going to be dealing with it this year. You drive careful.
Thank you.
Okay. 2.02, pool repair discussion. Terry?
Good evening, Mayor, Council. Tonight we want to brief you and inform you on our community pool here, some things we got going on and things that we've done and tested. Last year we closed the pool, latter part of the summer, and we shut all our valves down and we let the pool balance. And we were going to do some back flushing and some cleaning products. But anyway, we noticed that the pool was losing water. We also knew that as we were running through the season that we were losing some water. Booster pump was running more than it should. It would drain probably an inch and a half of water in the vault about every 20 minutes and fill for 15 on the booster pump. We had a hard time balancing this pool because we kept adding fresh water to it, kept diluting our chemicals. So it made it kind of hard to figure out what was going on with this because you really can't see a lot. You can view the mechanical side of it, but you really don't know what's underneath the slab, underneath the pool. So when we shut it down, we thought we'd start doing some investigating and do what we could as staff and test this. So we tested everything when we drained this. We waited for this thing to drain, and we noticed that in a couple days it drained a couple inches by itself. Over the period of 2 months, month and a half, it dropped 42 inches, and all the valves were off. There was no water running to waste. It was just dissipating. We didn't really know where it was going. So as soon as it got to the 42-inch level, it actually stopped, and it sat there for about 4 days and never went anywhere else. So at that point, we left the water in there, and we did some testing on some of the piping running out of the vault to the pump, out of the drains to the vault. We pressurized them. We tested them. We didn't come up with anything. So we called a couple people in. American Leak Detectors came in, and we started running some other tests on the piping that was in the pool, trying to figure out whether we had an actual scum gutter drain or a jet or an inlet floor drain that was leaking. We couldn't come up with anything. We did come up with one valve that operates a feature toy in the zero depth end that had a broken valve through an O-ring. It was cracked, and we replaced that. Now, we did some tests there, run some water through that, and we weren't able to get it to surface or any of that portion. So we do know that that's sitting on a pile of rock up there, and it dissipates quite well, and it doesn't surface outside the pool to make it a soggy mass to where you can pick up on anything leaking. So all said and done, the only conclusion that we came to at that point was to be able to, from the leak detectors, is to fill this pool this next go-around and go down and take a look at the floor drains and listen to them with a set of phones in the pool as the pool's running. Now, if you can see on the slide right here on the overhead, at the 42-inch level is somewhere right in here. This is the north end of the pool, the lap end of the pool. These are floor drains right here, floor inlets, all of these right here. We've tested all of these down through the scum gutters and through the eyelets and the globes in the side of the pool. But these two guys right in here seem to be where our 42-inch line drops for water. We don't know if it's this guy in this pipe or this guy here, but somewhere in here this line stops and you can have water in this end of the pool and it goes nowhere, but everything up to this point drains out. These little inlets right here, they have a valve in them, but the valve isn't designed to handle any pressure whatsoever. We have to put at least 8 pounds against that valve to hold it. It's not designed to hold that. So it makes it hard for us to pressurize this line right here and isolate each one of these. We can't get a plug in them because they've got an actual star fixture inside of them that holds this little valve. So we can't put a plug in this at all. This line comes clear back and comes over here and feeds out. We can sever this right here, but it wouldn't do us any good under the deck to sever it because we can't isolate any one of these to find this pipe that may be broke. Now, I'm saying may because we're not for sures. We know that the water stopped right in here on this 42-inch level. We could take water from rain and snow, and it can drift down into this pipe right here. It could have a belly in this pipe right here and create a break. We can't see it. It's down underneath the pool under the floor. So the only way to test this is to actually come in here when the pool's running and nobody's in it, pumps are all running, and listen to this line right here to see if we get a squeal out of this line. And they have a way of testing that. Staff has gone as far as they can go outside of jackhammers and backhoes and start pulling pipe and plugging things off, and I don't feel comfortable sawing holes in the bottom of a pool just taking a shot at whatever. I'm just not that kind of guy. So anyway, as we were doing all of this in here, we were testing a lot of things, looking at a lot of things, and we're going to go to another slide here, and we're going to kind of show you some of the other things that were happening in the pool here. As you can see, this picture right here, you got a red mark right there on a stick. That's the actual 42-inch mark on the pool. So that measures our depth to where the water quit draining. And this piece is actually sitting right on the bottom of the liner right here. You see that we've got some jets that are missing right here. We've got some cracked jets. We've got some grout lines right here that are missing grout. There's a stair right here. Can we scroll up there? You can see right here there's about a 3/4-inch crack on this, and they thought that this might be where we were losing some water. I don't think so. This liner goes underneath the steps right here, and then it turns up and comes up the wall. So it's a sealed unit all the way through here. We added some water in a vault right over here with a broken valve. We let it run in there at about 8 gallons a minute for about 45 minutes, and we never raised any water out of here at all. So we don't believe that underneath the stairs, this is just a beauty line, so to speak, where they grout this step into this pool liner, and it just dissolved away. We could never produce any water out of this at all. There's a lot of this grout that we're asking council to basically take a look at is to do the repairs to the pool through tile, our jets, our grout lines. We've got some liner issues in here. Down on the lap end of the pool where this drain is, we've got a drain in there that's basically doesn't drain. It's got a plug in it, but it doesn't drain. It's got a grout. It's got grout or concrete in it. The only way you can do is cut the liner, but I'm not your guy to cut that liner. I can't seal that liner. I don't even want to become a pool expert, really. So down on this drain is we're going to have to take a look at the drain because the liner's floating at the bottom end of the pool. You have to actually walk it to drain it. It shouldn't float. So we've got some issues there. As you can see, this seam on the lap end of the pool here is cracked. This is the actual liner cracked in the wall. You see we've got some edging here that's missing on the lanes on the floor of the pool. We've got some grout line right here with some edges that are missing, some tile. Let's go to the next slide there. Now we've got these inlets in the bottom of the pool. This is the ring that's on it. You can see the cracks right here. These cracks hold down against a gasket, and you see in this lower left side here, here's the gasket to that drain. This is the little valve right here. There's not much to that valve. That little screw right there screws into a little three-legged piece that's inside that inlet. This goes on top of it. This is all caused from just basically sun, expand and contract, warm, cold, and it cracks. Eventually, this has to be replaced. Now, this is the piece that holds down this gasket that holds the floor to the liner right here. So we have a few of these that are actually broke out in the pool. This has an O-ring underneath it, along with a gasket here that would be replaced. Let's scroll on up there. There's a grout line right here. This is all missing grout right here. You can see that this is gone. There's a lot of pieces right here that just disappeared. I don't know if it's from just the person didn't do it right or what, but there's a lot of it missing. For a pool that isn't very old, there's a lot that's missing out here. Let's scroll up. Now this is in the Lazy River area here, and you can see that this seam right here It's got rust spots in it. It's bleeding through this liner where these two are pieced together. You can see the bubble in the liner down here where it hits the pool bottom. You see it here again. These are some of the issues that we have going on in the pool. Scroll on up. We've got some of these that are disappearing here now. We've got some reasoning for some of those. And a lot of this is done with kids that are swimming in the pool here. And these have been pulled off. These just don't fall off. So these have disappeared. There's some of that. And you'll see in this next slide, you'll see where we've got some lights. These seem to be the best workout for kids, is they put their feet against the wall and they grab onto this big guy right here, and this is what it looks like after they pry it off the wall. There's a plastic ring right here that mates against the wall, and they've distorted this can that this light tips out on so bad that we can't put it back against the wall. There's also in here is a wire that comes through this wall in a sleeve, a conduit basically. There's no seal to this. So water can enter this and then run down the conduit. And it may run out behind this wall. I don't know. It might be a direct burial wire after it leaves the conduit for a sleeve. But we went through and we took in these cans and opened them up, and we've sealed that hole so that we can't lose any water. So we've done just about everything that the staff can do to try and find this leak. But we're going to have to do it this next year during pool season, just before pool opens, so that we can actually pressurize this line and get it to run and see what we come up with. The repairs to the liner, the lights, the plastic pieces, the globes, the drain in the bottom of the pool, your grout lines, your race lines, those are all going to be repaired. It's going to cost us about $20,000 to do this. We're going to absorb it what we can in the water side of our budget, operational budget this year, and we'll take a look at it midway down through the year to see how we are. I think we'll be all right at that point, but just to let council know that that's what we're going to take a look at and try and do. Now, this has to come off. I think they told us 46 degrees. It has to be above 46 degrees before they can do any of this work. So, or we'd be a little quicker at it. But we kind of got to wait for the weather, wait for the temperature to get it done. So, right at this time, we're kind of stalemated. I'm hoping that I come up with no so-called leak in a line, because we really don't want to go down and pull the liner loose and drill a hole in the floor. This is not a good thing, but hopefully the liner has enough leakage in it that we're leaking it through there and not somewhere else. So at this time, we're going to proceed through and absorb it in our daily operations, and we'll probably be looking at somewhere latter part of this month that they said they could actually start and proceed to reseal, and they're going to have to go down on the bottom side of the pool and take a look at that drain. They say it's there, but we haven't found it. You got to cut the liner to actually see it. We can't feel it under the liner. But we know that when we drained it, we couldn't drain it all. We had to squeegee it around to the other drain to get it to drain. So they're supposed to fix all of that. And the people that will be doing the work will be the people that actually put the pool in, Wayne Smith, WMS out of Ellensburg, that will be in to do that work. If you got any questions, I'll take those now.
So quite a bit of damage was done to vandalism.
We've been fighting that for a while, picking at the tile. If you get a little bit of the grout line gone, they flop the tile up, and the last couple of years we put it down. There's a fair amount. I mean, the stuff in the bottom of the pool it just doesn't come off. It's built not to come off. You've got to go down there to do that. And we're going to, on my end of stick, we're going to take a good look at our guards and do some more training on our guards to be a little more proactive on this, because just taking a nap on the guard stand isn't cutting it. We need to they need to be a little more involved in the people that are around there. So we need to get after them and train them a little bit more.
Do you think it would be, I mean, you see it in the residential pools a lot where they leave the water in, and they stick something in there to, I guess, to float it up on the ice.
Yeah, they put a barrel.
That would be to any of our advantage to maybe make our pool last longer? Or?
I don't really know that. In the O&M manual that I have, it doesn't state to do that. Hmm. There's a lot of things in the O&M manual that we've done and faithfully, and some of them I've asked, and they didn't advise it. So. No, I would have. I want to say one more thing. Is in the budget. This has been asked a couple different times, but we didn't budget for this money because we didn't really know what we had. Early in the year, we were still testing. We didn't really know. So for me to throw some money and come up to council and say, "Hey, I need some money," and find out that I need more or I didn't need it. That's not me. I'd rather not run a department that way. So I'd rather have the facts and present the facts to you and do it properly the first time and when we know something rather than just take a shot in the dark. So.
In other words, what you're saying right now, you're going to try to absorb it into your budget, but there's a chance that you may have to come back with a budget amendment.
There's a chance.
Later in the year.
Yes, later in the year, midway through the year, something like that, not sure. It'll be... We'll put it in the water department. We've tested the two times that we've tested, we've absorbed it in the water department. So we're going to go at that and see how we, and we'll just monitor and see how we come out at this time.
Well, thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
2.03 tourism tax update. Spencer?
Thank you very much, Council. Tonight, I just wanted to briefly give you kind of an overview of the world of hotel motel tax and some of the just what's going on with that tax, what we use it for now, and what that's going to be looking like going into the future. I'm passing out a house bill that we'll talk about here in just a sec also. The hotel motel tax right now, we collect that money in our tourism fund. And that's the money that we dole out during our budgeting season to the different organizations that promote tourism within the city. And we give 5,000 here, 500 there, 1,000 over here. So the hotel motel tax, the way the law reads is it allows us to spend that money for advertising and marketing costs. In 2007, there was a clause that was added to that, or there was some litigation that was added to the law that expanded what we can use that for. So it wasn't just advertising and marketing, but we could also use that money for just the general operational costs of these organizations in our community that organize events and things that attract tourism to our area. And so that's great. It turns out that those expanded uses of those funds had a sunset clause on them. So coming up to June 30th of this year, the allowed uses of those funds are going to shrink back down to just the advertising costs that the law originally allowed. So there are a couple different things that can happen. One is the law reversed back to the way it was, and we can still give money to these organizations that have applied for money, but we can only reimburse them for advertising type expenses. There's a house, so that's one avenue, one thing that can happen. The other thing that can happen is related to this House bill that I passed out to you. There's a House bill and there's also a Senate bill, and they're the exact same thing. The verbiage is the exact same. They're just moving through their respective houses. So this House bill here would change the law, getting rid of the sunset clause. I marked a couple of key points in the House bill here. If you look on the very front page there, I have some little brackets around some language. And here the language says that we can use the money for marketing and operations of special events and festivals, along with the mentions a marketing. So there's a marketing, that's the advertising piece. But it also talks about the operations of special events. And so this is the language that we want to have retained in the law. If you flip over, there's some verbiage down here that affects some of the reporting that we would need to do and some of the reporting that the organizations would need to provide us. Just some numbers on the number of tourists that they bring to the area. We're doing a lot of those things right now already. But if you go to page 4, lines 9 and 10, number 9, it says, amendments made in section 1, which is including the advertising, the operations of these types of facilities. So the laws of 2007 expire June 30th, 2013. And so this item 9 in the House bill is getting rid of the language the sunset language. So that's a good thing there. And then down below, this act is necessary for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, and safety. So this bill here does a couple of different things. It gets rid of the sunset clause so we can continue moving or continue using the money as we have been. And tonight I just wanted to bring this up to your attention. It's something that's happening as we speak. It's kind of a live animal. This House bill and the Senate bill have both passed their first reading. They have a second and a third reading to pass before they can be signed into law before the governor. This is where we're at. We drafted letters out to the organizations that receive this money, letting them know that there's legislation that could limit what we can fund. Obviously, I expressed our appreciation for their organizations and what they do for the community, and we hope that we can continue using this money the way we have. But there are some struggles that are affecting the state and us, and this way, you can kind of know where we're at with this funding source.
Yeah, I kind of go along with what you're saying here. I've been following those bills pretty close. Actually, there's three of them, but the two that you're talking about is the main ones. The other one is a technical definition of what is tourism, but it kind of ties in with the same thing. But when Ken and I were over to Olympia with AWC, I talked to some people about this very thing that you're talking about. And it could create quite a problem with what's going on with our different organizations that do get funded from this. And the problem is, like you say, it's got a sunset clause of June 30th. In other words, if you've got a festival or something coming up and you don't use that money before June 30th, you won't get it for this year. And it could affect on down the road, too, as far as how this would work. I think, this is kind of my own opinion, but from who I talked to over there, I think they'll probably continue that. I think they'll extend that thing on through. They was getting some pretty good favoritism as far as what their thoughts were on that. The only other thing is the definition of tourism. That was a clause in there, and it's related directly to whether you use it for advertising and that type, or if you use it for some other thing. Like you say, at one time they had a clause in there for a one-time use. You can use some of that money for certain things. We actually did that with the old hotel down here when we had a certain item that they needed to be bought for their old hotel. With that clause being in there, we were able to do that. But if that clause is gone, it would only be for advertising. That's
Yeah, the House bill that you have in front of you right now mentions some of the definitions of a tourist has to be somebody that lives or comes from beyond 50 miles of the city into the city, and that's some of the language that you'll see crossed off in the bill there.
So. And these bills are changing continually. While they're, in fact, there's a new update here, and I'll read up some of the updates. This is the latest version. It's a substitute bill of House Bill 1253, which was just passed out of the House Finance Committee on Thursday. Mm-hmm. And here's some of the changes. It allows cities and counties to continue the funding operations of nonprofit organizations operating tourism-related facilities. Prohibits lodging revenue from being used for capital expenditures of a facility owned by nonprofit. Capital funding may still be provided to a facility operated by a nonprofit if it is owned by a public entity. The second one allows revenue to be used to attract local travelers, not just tourists, and defines both terms. That's how it gets out, local travelers. And here's one that's going to affect a lot of the groups. It requires recipients of lodging taxes to submit estimates of tourism and local travel benefits with their funding application, and then submit a post-event report of the actual benefits, and the local government receiving these reports must submit them to the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Committee, which I believe is our audit review committee that we have here, and the local lodging tax advisory committee. In turn, the Legislative Audit and Review Committee must submit reports detailing the use of economic impact of the revenue to specified legislative committees every 2 years.
Right now we have some reports that we file annually, and we also require some information to be provided to us from the organizations that receive money. And you're right, this will change some of what we report, what we do or don't. Some of that stuff we're doing already, we'll need to do a little bit more. And the information that we already request from the organizations that receive this money, that's just kind of reiterated in these bills. And we do those.
Yeah, and it's also going to require the Lodging Tax Advisory Committee to prioritize a list of the recipients receiving these funds too. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how things shake out. It's been moving pretty quickly through the House and the Senate, and so it's had one reading with the at the committee level. I think the next reading was with the Rules Committee, and then it goes to the floor. So those are the second and third readings. Then after that, we'll have the final word, hopefully.
Any other questions from council?
There's one other thing. It was brought to my attention the question was raised: can we use tourism funds for the coloring books that have been brought? There's a woman in the community that has drawn pictures that are unique to Othello. And the question was raised: can we use tourism funds to help this as a tourist type item for the community? So I asked the state auditor's office, and I didn't get a direct no, but they said if we help to fund these coloring books, and we have some that are available at City Hall and some at the school and some at the library, or I don't know where we put them. But if they were in locations like that, then it would kind of be hard to justify spending this money on them. Because are they really exposing people outside of our community to our community? So if we help fund these coloring books, and we have some of them in Spokane, up in Wenatchee, at their city halls, yeah, or Tri-Cities, just places that are outside of our community, saying, look what Othello has to offer. then it'd be a little bit easier to justify using some of that money for that project. So that's just kind of a FYI. Yeah.
Okay.
That's all I got. Thanks.
2.04, speed limit on 7th from Olympia Street North to Lee Street. Chief Dunnigan?
Mayor, council members, good evening.
I'm going to move the sign out a little bit more so you can see it over better. It's not really a sign, it's something I drew up earlier today. Can you all see it? Kind of right there?
A while back, there was a question that was posed. Sorry, Brianna. I'll show you later. A while back, there was a question that was posed, and the question was, why is the speed limit on 7th Avenue different for the two different directions? Going outbound, the speed limit is 35 miles per hour. Coming inbound, the speed limit is 25 miles per hour. It, along with the agenda memo, you should have got two attachments. One is the actual state law, which actually prescribes and sets maximum speed limits on all streets. So 7th Avenue technically is a city street, so technically the maximum speed limit on 7th Avenue should be 25 miles per hour. The good news is that if you follow a process where we get an engineer and a small traffic investigation to say that the speed limit is too low, we can change it as a local authority. However, I went out today just to get a feel for how much distance and everything. That stretch between Lee Street and Olympia Street, which is the section that we're talking about tonight, is only 0.5 mile long. It comes into a school zone marker that's 300 feet north of the intersection of Olympia and 7th because there's a school crosswalk or at least a crossing there that could be used for school children. So if we changed it from 25 inbound, we would have to put the 25 mile per hour sign just to the north of the school zone sign because we wouldn't want 35 through a school zone, and then we would have to put up the proper reduction sign, which is forewarning for the motorist, hey, the speed limit is changing right up here a little bit, so you're going to have to decrease your speed. And Terry was good enough to figure out that distance for me, and that's 290 feet. So by the time that we got that all marked off, if you wanted to change it to 35 inbound for a section of the road prior to when the 25 should take over, then we're actually saving about 0.3 mile for the motorist to do 35 miles per hour, or roughly 1,500 feet. So the question is that worth the effort to change that to 25, number one. And then number two, we need to do a little bit of research on the outbound lane to find out if that 35 miles per hour was actually based on some kind of engineer's letter or whatever that said that was safe to do. And then we should probably do the same for 14th Avenue. I was going through the OMCs and the web page, and once upon a time, the OMC actually listed 14th Avenue between Olympia and Lee Street as 35 miles per hour. It does not list it anymore, but the signs are still up there. So with regard to the ordinance only specifies the exemptions from the state law. So every road that has a different speed limit than what state law prescribes, it's listed in the ordinance. So we need to update our ordinance as well and put those roads in there that are exceptions to the rules. If you look in the ordinance right now, the one that's listed is Broadway. It's listed at 35 and 50 miles per hour where it starts down there south of town. Pine Street is listed because you lowered the speed limit from 25 to 20 miles per hour, and that's the only exceptions. So we need to update our ordinance a little bit. as well. But that is the issue. That was the question that was raised. Why is it one direction in one way and another speed in a different direction? And that is the only thing that I can tell you at this point. It's by state law, all city streets are to be 25 unless you decide otherwise. If you decide otherwise, then we need to base that on an engineer's study, say that it's safe, get that blessing, and then take and move that section of the roadway into the ordinance and list it as an exception to the rule. Anybody have any questions?
Well, looking at it, you know, if you just got that short distance of a quarter of a mile, and why change it? You know, but that's the way I look at it. It's working the way it is. I know I've had some people ask me, well, why is it 25 one direction, 35 the other way? I get a ticket because I'm going 38 mile an hour or whatever, you know. Well, it's a big deal. Our 14th Street going south out here by our new school at one time was the same situation. We had 25 and 40, one direction one way and one the other. And everybody asked that same question. Why do you come roaring into town 40 mile an hour and come down to 25? Then we had a stop at the same at a school crossing. So we had to cut it down. So I think you've got the same problem out here. I think it should remain like we got it, at least for now. And then possibly later on, even cut the other one down to 25. But I think it ought to stay 25 to 35.
That's a good point. 14th was higher speed limits. But when we started adding feeder roads to that and then the school, that had to be reduced because the 35 and 40 was just too fast.
But what you're saying also, too, on 14th Street where it's 35 and then also 7th Street where it's going out at 35, we have to have an engineer come in and tell us that it's okay to have...
By, according to state law, if you want to deviate from the maximum speed limits, then we need to ask the engineer. And I talked to Larry Julius, and I don't think it's all that complicated for him to go out there and look at that and say, you know what, it's a two-lane road, it's good road, it has wide shoulders, there is no driveways connected to it, 35 would be a safe speed. Once that starts changing, we start adding houses and roads and everything else, then it would have to come back down. I don't think it's a real complicated process, but yeah, by state law, if we want to deviate, we're supposed to do that.
Is that something the council would like? So to maintain the 35 on 14th, you're saying we need to have a study done?
Well, I will work with Debbie to find out if that was even done, because when I was doing some research into the old OMC, 35 was listed on 14th between Olympia and Lee Street. So there may be in the archives, there may be already some of that paperwork. We just need to find it, look at it, declare it, and then go ahead and get it back into the ordinance as an exception to the speed limits.
It's my opinion, 7th Avenue, we should just go ahead and do 25 both ways instead of studying and then talking a half a mile that I drive twice a day, you know, it's like, it's not, 14th I can see leaving at 35 and doing it for there, but not 7th, but I don't know, that's just my opinion.
Any comments?
Talking about 14th, I think that issue come up here a couple of years ago. We talked about that for quite a while, and I think we changed that ordinance, or at least we talked about changing it. We never completed that, but that was an issue that we talked about. That.
We actually took it to 225 and then bumped it back up to 35 from, I believe, Olympia.
Well, it was probably 35 because we just took that into the city not that long ago.
Yeah, when we changed it on 14th mm-hmm. for the south portion of 14th Avenue, it was included in the ordinance.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So as far as the council, the 35 going out, any comments on that?
I think I agree with Eugene. It ought to be 25 both ways. I know by the time
you hit the reduction sign down here, and you got to get your foot out of the carburetor. You've only gone a third of a mile. So, you know, that doesn't even give you a good run out for a drag. So I just make it 25 miles an hour both ways, and that way nobody's confused about it because, you know, I talked to a couple of people who got nailed out there coming in 35 miles an hour. What's the deal? You know, I 35 going out. Well, forgot to read the sign. It's only 25 coming in. So you make it both ways and let it go with that.
That's correct. It is marked as soon as you come, as soon as you turn off Lee Street, it is marked with a big 25 mile an hour speed zone sign. And that's our duty as drivers is to look for the signs. Not a lot of people get stopped out there. We went back and checked the records. Over a year, a little over a year's time, there's only been 21 people stopped out there. So it's not like it's a big ticket location.
I won't tell you who it was. You probably find it if you dig deep enough.
I don't mind seeing it 25. Like I said, for a half a mile, 10 miles an hour difference is just a matter of seconds.
Okay.
The longer it's going to take.
Well, it's a city street, and 25 mile an hour is the maximum by RCW, unless we want to deviate from that by doing those things. So I'll work with Terry. We'll get the signs put back up. We'll advertise. We'll do an education section to make sure everybody understands that it's 25 both directions, and we'll go with that if that's what your direction is.
Is there not a difference in the state law between city streets, residential streets, ones that are their main, like 14th is a main road, Broadway's main? Is a main road.
The state sets the maximum speeds, but then gives ways that you can change. Like the local jurisdiction is to figure out what speed limit they want on all their arterials. So the closest thing that we really have to arterials is Main Street and Broadway. So those have already been set, 25 on Main, and then Broadway you have 35, 25, 35, and then at the south end of town, just once you get past the storage facility, it turns to 50 all the way out to Highway 24.
Consensus to drop it back to 25, correct? Okay. But that's the direction we're going.
Okay.
On 7th.
On 7th, both directions.
Hopefully get rid of some of the confusion.
We'll make that happen.
Okay. Any other questions for the chief?
Thank you.
Chief, we have any committee reports? Good. Yeah.
Could have done this last meeting. I might have been more up to date than I am this meeting because I'm confused. But anyway, Ken and I went to AWC. I won't take his fire away from him to do some of this. But a lot of these bills, exactly what we were talking about here, was a pretty hot item with AWC over there on those issues. There's three or four others. There's one with our public records, which is a big issue here in Othello and other communities. Pullman's got a problem. Pasco's got a problem. Several other towns, I'm not going to mention all of them. Spokane's had to put extra people on just to take care of some of the public records problems. And there's a couple bills going through to maybe help on that. And hopefully that we get some relief from some of these issues that's going on. I'm not going to go into it, but I think everybody's aware of what's happening. And hopefully that'll help us. I'm going to hit a couple others here, and then I think I'll let Ken talk about a few of them. A couple of them that kind of was interesting to me. As you know, our liquor revenue tax money has dropped quite a bit since it got privatized. And the state's looking at that, trying to figure out what to do with that issue. They're trying to get about $10 million back and send it back to the cities. It hasn't happened yet, but it's in the bill. Maybe be able to do this. I'm not sure. taxes on liquor or what they're going to do, but there's an issue in there. What happened is they lost the profit revenue, which your companies like Walmart, Costco, and all of those picked up that portion of it. They were able to pick up some of the tax portion of it, so when the individual went out and bought his booze, it ended up costing the same amount of money or more than what it did originally. But they lost that revenue from the profit side of it. And the state's looking at that, trying to figure out a way to help that out and help the cities retain some of that money back. So I think it'll be a big help if that does help, if they do figure out some way to do that. Ken, why don't you say a couple things and then let me come back. I've got a couple more here, but I don't want to stick to the fire.
They did have a short segment on the 502, the marijuana issue. They had some of the state officials there from the Liquor Control Board. I don't know if we got a straight answer from them or if they were able to give a straight answer to the crowd. They have set up a timeline for their process of getting all this stuff done. But as you know, Colorado Auto also passed a similar law allowing marijuana, but they're also 6 months ahead in the process. So Washington was kind of just setting back, seeing how theirs is going to go, and kind of following some of their steps into it. It's going to be very interesting how this plays out, especially at the very end, because right now they're proposing three different levels of taxing, and they're 25% at each level from the grower, producer, or the person that either turns it into an oil or prepares it for the retail, and then also another 25% at the retail. And I could see that being a big problem, because you're still going to have your person out on the street selling it too. And it's just going to become a competitive market, especially since it's not going to be taxed that way. But there's no way to enforce it once that person has it on his personal, when he has his soap 1 ounce that they're allowed up to. So it's going to be really hard on the enforcement part of that. I see some problems definitely coming up with that, but it's going to be interesting to watch. We covered the hotel motel tax, the liquor revenues that we might be losing, public hearings request. I mean, public records request, that is going to be a battle. That is a battle. Unfortunately, there's a lot of cities out there that are hurting, and there was a lot of cities. They're defending the current bill 1128, but and it made there's been several amendments to that bill, which would exempt the press from it. But there's a big push by the press right now to completely knock this out, bill completely out of the circulation. As much as the governments want to be open, and we want to be open, for sure we want to be open, but there is a lot of abuse in the system, and our problems were small to some of them that we heard. There's even one town that's talking about disincorporating because of the cost to the town. The citizens did not want to disincorporate, so they're bringing a special levy to help pay for legal fees that they've incurred because of public records requests. And I can't think of anything else right off the top. top of my head. I know it'll come to me a little bit later, but these conferences are very informative, and are really, if any council member get a chance to go next year, it's really worth the time. It's really worth the time. It's informative. Not only do you get to learn the process in Olympia, but you make a lot of good other contacts with some of the other cities and find out what they're doing. And discussion and some of the problems that they're having. And sometimes they've run across the problems that we've already had that we've worked through that you could give them some suggestions on what they could do. And there's been a lot of cities there that flip-flop have went through the problems that we are going through now that have suggestions for us that we could do. One of them that we need to work on, and we brought it up to the legislators, is with the Department of Revenue and the way they collect some of the funds on our utility tax fund, and their lack of time in between when they got their notice and when they notified us. Our representatives were very interested in that, and they're going to look at that possibly. And AWC was very interested in it too, because it's what's happened here is we're one of the first cities that it's happened to, and it may open up the doors for future things for other revenues. I mean, not revenues for us, but other cities have to repay some of these revenues.
I just want to take away from Ken here, because I know he talked to several people about some different items. I've got a couple more here. They've got an issue that's coming up that they're, I hope it doesn't go anywhere. But for annexation into your city, they're talking about having a voter approval rather than coming through a council there or whatever. Can you imagine how long it would take to go through that process? If somebody wanted to come out here and buy a piece of land and develop it, by the time you got it up for a voter to do something with that and got it on the ballot, it would be a year down the road. That guy might say, well, heck with that, I'm going somewhere else. And I can see a lot of little issues, like you want to annex just a small area. But probably even if you wanted to change some of your zoning, technically they would probably get into this same process. And AWC is totally against that, so that's something to look out for. Another one is an issue that they're talking about any public vehicles, in other words, are bought from tax money, like cities, counties, state. They're going to an alternative fuel, in other words, like propane or natural gas. I know years ago we used to have our police force here in Othello, used to be on propane. That's all the cars run that way. I remember you used to get off shift, you'd go just before you got off, you'd fill up with your propane and ready for the next guy to take over your shift. But it we used to call them gutless wonders, but they got the job done. But it's getting, they're pushing this issue very hard, so I don't know where that was going to go.
Currently the law right now, by the year 2015, all city fleet vehicles have to be alternative fuels. So they're working on something to help. Unfortunately, this is one of those unfunded mandates that they are working on to try to either give more time to do it or lax it off a little bit.
Some possibly good news. You know, we're talking about the East Low Canal out here, the expansion of that. From what I can gather, $33 million for that continuation of that project. Don't quote me, but I think that they're looking at about 28.5 about what they're possibly going to get. But that doesn't actually come out of this budget. There's money already available there. There was $100 million put into the Columbia River projects and whatnot. And they think that that's where that money's going to actually come from. So it's not going to actually come out of the, per se, this budget. So it's already been budgeted prior to this. But anyway, it's probably good news from our perspective of this whole area. And one other thing, the books that you guys signed, you know, at John Height, produced here 3-4 months ago, 6 months ago. I personally delivered that one to the governor the other day over there. And about 2 months ago, I personally delivered the one to Maria Pamela. So if you wondered what happened to them, they're in their hands. Jay says, thank you. He says, I'll look at it. I delivered a couple more besides that. But anyway, I thought it was good to show them.
Something I don't know if all the council members get the legislative bulletin through their email through the AWC, but it's interesting to take the 15-20 minutes it takes to read through that, but I suggest that everybody should read that, and it gives a really good update on what's going on week to week with AWC and the legislative.
Any other committees? Okay, do we have any unfinished business? New business? Okay, the mayor's announcements. Filing period for this year for elected officials is in May. So you can email on that if you're interested in running again. And also daylight savings time is this weekend. So everybody knows that, it's spring forward. Don't forget, yes, this weekend already, it's hard to believe. Other than that, unless there's any other subjects, this meeting's adjourned. Thank you, everybody, for coming.